This episode is sponsored by ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems Canada, TKMSC for short. TKMSC offers Canada a broad product portfolio, world-leading non-nuclear submarines, high-end naval surface vessels, and outstanding naval electronic systems. Along with the recent contract award for remote mine hunting and disposal, TKMSC contributes to the national shipbuilding strategy through work on the JSS, AOPS, and CSC. The company, via full corporate support, intends to compete for the upcoming Canadian Patrol Submarine Project with the CD-212 family of submarines. With TKMSC's Canadian base of operations and its long-standing relationship with the RCN, plus its parent company's significant modern manufacturing facilities in Kiel, Germany, TKMSC has a commitment, capability, and capacity to ensure the success of Canada's upcoming submarine project. Visit the ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems website for more information and visit their booth at CANSEC to find out why 70% of NATO navies trust TKMS Conventional Submarine Solutions.
Welcome to Canadian Defence Focus from CDR Radio, produced by Canadian Defence Review Magazine. This series of podcasts features interviews with leaders and experts in the defence industry, as well as reports and profiles on the very latest in defence technology.
Hello, everyone. Thanks to tuning in to CDR Radio. My name is Jody Atariwala, and I am the aviation editor and senior staff writer for the magazine. In this episode, we are going to discuss the long-awaited and recently released Defense Policy Update, which has been released by the Government of Canada. Joining me today are some well-known subject matter experts in defense and foreign policy, and they are Christian Cianfrani, who is the president of the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries, generally known as CADSI, Aaron O'Toole, who served in the Canadian Armed Forces and is a member of the Conservative Party. Mr. O'Toole served as the leader of the official opposition from 2020 to 2022. Also joining is David Perry, the president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. And we have Alan Williams, former Assistant Deputy Minister Materiel at the Department of National Defense and the current president of the Williams Group. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining me today. So the topic is the DPU, which is titled Our North Strong and Free. And I think the best way to start is for each of my guests to take a few moments to share their initial thoughts on the DPU, and then we can take it from there. So Kristen, how about we start with you, please?
CADSI released a statement, right? And our thinking went something like this. It's incredibly important for this document to be released. And for all of its faults, and there is no lack of hot takes on everything from it not meeting 2% of GDP to it being back-end loaded, lack of big ticket items being covered off. But it set down an important marker for this government and for any future ones on the ambitions and intentions of the promises that are being made to other nations and domestically. So it's incredibly important. For industry, it's incredibly important because we now know what is funded and what is not funded or aspirational, even if it is in the future. And that is the only way that business leaders can make a case, particularly if they're subsidiaries of foreign primes, for being able to point to something, although we prefer contracts, but something, certainly not tweets, that is going on within the country. The other thing it does is that it releases top cover for a lot of initiatives that are ongoing that have been stuck in this DPU logjam. So I know that's not the sexy bit for those who are just looking at the money, but there are a lot of initiatives that are covered off in that needed top cover, like a different relationship with industry, which is partially related to other initiatives that are covered off in the document, like continuous capability sustainment initiative, and buried deep in there, a road mapping exercise, in this case, what I would consider almost like a pilot project on armor. So that lets us begin the activity of attacking, if you will, what those things look like, and chipping away at what building a stronger defense industry here in Canada actually means, as opposed to consultation continuing on for an indefinite period of time. So for us, it was about, you know, let not the perfect be the enemy of, I guess, modest in this case, right? So I'll leave it at that.
Beautiful. Thank you, Christian. That's a lovely industry perspective. Aaron, over to you.
I used to say when I was in politics, especially in the opposition, that you have to listen to your mother, your grandmother's advice. If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. So the one nice thing I will say off the top is I'm glad they framed it as our North strong and free. Arctic and Arctic sovereignty was an issue that was very important to me for 10 years in politics. And I think they're attempting to finally articulate to Canadians that we have an obligation to assert our sovereignty and to play our role within NORAD and within NATO. And for Canadians who've been lulled into the sense that, you know, we're surrounded by three oceans and we sit on the doorstep of the world superpower, we don't need defense, we don't need to spend big sums of money. The Arctic is something Canadians understand. And I used to always say, we not only have to monitor, and the North Warning investments from a few years ago will be part of that, we need to be able to act and assert our sovereignty properly. So I think the positive with the title and the discussion of the geopolitical situation is I think this government, for the first time in their run, are trying to articulate a need for defense policy, a need for defense spending, a need to work with industry like CADSEA to deliver on our priorities. With the good thing out of the way, I will say what frustrates me is always a lot of back-end loading of money. And with a government that is low in the polls and really a year away from potential election, the proof will be in the pudding of the budget. And what are they going to commit in the short term in terms of new dollars? We saw up to $10 billion in new money over the next 5 years, but they may be only in government for one. So I really think that there needs to be certainty about some of the pieces of equipment and capability that we need. They're exploring a lot of things in this document that really doesn't tell you much, and it's hard for industry to come up with long-term supply solutions. So I would like a little more money in the budget, perhaps, and a little more certainty on what is the short-term priority.
Yeah, you know what? That was really good perspective, because I noted that as well. There was a lot of exploring in the DPU, and I'm not really sure what that means, you know, in terms of actual effect. David, you're up.
So maybe to kind of stitch together between a couple of things that both Aaron and Chris said, I mean, I think I'd look at this as a piece building off of Strong, Secure, Engage from 2017. And at least in the Department of National Defense's minds, they had to write an unwritten chapter that would address continental defense, NORAD, and I think more substantive look at the Canadian North, which is partially, I think, delivered by both the document delivered on April 8th, our North Strong and Free, as well as the list of quite extensive investments published in June of 2022 that didn't really have a covering policy, for which our North Strong and Free, I think, provides kind of the policy chapeau, if you will, that fits both the June 2022 announcements and investments, as well as those that came in April 2024. And if you stitch those together, in the last 2 years, the government's committed a couple hundred billion dollars on a cash basis to a range of different investments, on top of several dozen billions of dollars on a cash basis that were provided in June of 2017 with Strong, Secure, Engaged. So altogether, like, you're talking about a commitment of something like $250 billion over slightly different 20-year timeframes, which is pretty serious money. When you think a lot of perspectives, it's a generational investment that's been committed to, not yet delivered, but the funding's been committed. So that's quite important from that perspective. I think it's interesting, though, to Aaron's point about the whole list of things that have only been identified for exploration, which really means that essentially there's policy coverages to do them, but not the actual money to make them real. But there's still an acknowledgement that those things need to be done. And I think it's notable that even with, you know, approaching $250 billion worth of investment, there's still a long list of things that the Canadian Armed Forces will no longer be in the business of doing in relatively short order unless somebody actually steps in with the check to deliver on the policy commitment. with any one of these policies, I guess in my view, you can always find 5 or 10% of it that you disagree with or think should be plus or minus. But on the whole, this is pretty good, I think, in terms of the strategic assessment. It's really a question of how much funding has been committed to how much and how much is actually achievable, especially as Aaron noted, where the government is in its electoral cycle. So a lot of this depends on whoever forms the next government to either do, not do, leave aside, et cetera, because they're not going to be able to do an awful lot of this before they have to go to the polls.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's going to be a lot to unpack there. And Alan, over to yourself.
Well, I think the DPU was an unmitigated disaster, frankly. I was looking for four things, none of which were in there. First of all, I don't know how you can have a defense policy update without a foreign policy update as a foundation. Defense is just, is one of three components, typically diplomacy and development assistance. We don't know that. And without that, it's hard for me to really understand the role that the government wants to play. That became evident in the Q&A. I remember Minister Blair was asked about civil assistance, and he said yes, but he's not sure how it impacts on other operations. Well, that's the point. We need to know exactly what the government is expecting from the military to deliver, and we don't know that. Secondly, I think the costing was atrocious. They talked about $73 billion over 20 years. The fact is, with the F-35 and the CSC disaster, we're going to be short $100 billion in the next 10 years. To me, for the costing to be effective, there should have been a 20-year plan identifying all the programs, their acquisition of long-term costs over the 20 years, mapped against the available funding. That's when we know when something is costed or not, it's in there or not, and whether it's adequate. Again, the submarines came out, disagreement between the Prime Minister and Blair about conventional or nuclear, and we found that they're not costed. So we don't know what's in there. We don't know what's not in there. The third aspect that I thought was really lacking is governance. If you're going to develop a policy, when are you trying to make sure it's implemented? And there's two key things that weren't in there. Again, I've said this many times, we're the only country in the Western world without one minister accountable. I think that's atrocious. That caused time delays. Everybody complains about it, but it's easy to fix. When you go up the two departmental organizations rather than one, that takes money. The other aspect that you can't have now that you could if one minister was accountable is a performance measure. There's nothing in there. The government talks about retention, hiring more people. Those are cheap words. They didn't say how many or what percentage. There's nothing in there hard and fast about actual targets that you can monitor them against. A dozen times plus, we talked about exploring or seeking, nothing definitive. Having said all that, I was pleased that they're going to be doing a defense update regularly. I think that's healthy. And I was pleased about missile defense. I think that's great too. But by and large, huge disappointment to me. My expectations were very high or higher, obviously. And I don't know who wrote it, but I certainly wouldn't want my name attached to it.
Yeah, so there's a lot to discuss there. And so, how about we start from the title? And Aaron, you referenced it. Have the liberals in titling this document, have they taken away the conservatives' thunder? Because the Arctic was kind of the conservatives' thing.
I got into a discussion with that the other day. That wasn't the case, actually. Historically, if you go back to, Mackenzie King, it wasn't always just a Canadian thing. Certainly, Diefenbaker was probably the strongest prime minister we've ever had on the North. It was a big issue for Prime Minister Harper. He used to go to Operation Nanook every year, and Justin Trudeau never went until the NATO Secretary General came, and he kind of had to go. My grandfather served in the Aleutian campaign with the RCAF. In fact, I've reminded my friends in the U.S. Senate before that the Canadians deployed to Alaska pre-NORAD to defend the U.S. from a Japanese attack, or they held a few Aleutian islands. It ended up being a lot of work to get up there, and the Japanese had already left. But our history of continental defense and the Permanent Joint Board on Defense was a liberal creation. And so historically, this was an area of nonpartisanship. And I think for any long-term infrastructure or defense plan for the North, we have to make it nonpartisan. And, you know, Harper's three major investments in the Arctic, the High Arctic Research Station, CHARS, the road to the Arctic Ocean, the road to Tuktoyaktuk, and the Naval Refueling Station at Nanisivik. Nanisivik is not completed yet. These projects are so complex, so expensive, we almost have to make this nonpartisan. So in the last year of the Liberal government, are they trying to do a little bit more in the North? Yes, I don't think it's going to steal the Conservatives' thunder, because most of the stuff they were talking about was in my platform in 2021. That said, my sincere hope is that this becomes much more of a nonpartisan issue, because we have to commit 25-year plans to build out proper infrastructure in the North, and we have to engage Inuit, Indigenous, industry, military in the process. I said last week at an Arctic event in Toronto, we the North needs to be more than a Raptors slogan. It needs to be a part of the Canadian identity, and defense and sovereignty is key to that.
Yeah, Alan, I think you want to add to that.
Yeah, I don't think the Conservatives have to worry at all. This, to me, this is so opaque. There's nothing in there hard and fast. And in fact, I think their communication gurus are going to say they've gone from SSC to NSF. And everybody knows what NSF is. So I think they've got a lot that they can do without feeling constrained or feeling that they were undermined by this doctrine.
So we've all been waiting 2 years for this. The DPU was announced 2 years ago that it was going to be coming. And now here we are in 2024. Why now?
Why now? Because our allies are really, really, really mad at us. And so if you talk to any ambassador from a NATO country, Canada is a laggard and we're losing our influence. I think Prime Minister Trudeau desperately wants Canada to be part of Pillar 2 of AUKUS. And so we have to at least make it look like we're trying to get close to 2% in order to come in. I call Pillar 2 the kids' table at Christmas dinner. At least we'll be part of the technology sharing. At least we'd be preserving our interests in the Indo-Pacific. So I think that's the main reason for now, is really there's been a lot of pressure from the Americans. And if he wants to do something while there's a president that will return his calls, I think that's the timing for Prime Minister Trudeau right now.
Yeah. David, what are your thoughts?
I think there's probably something to that, but I don't know how many of Aaron's reallys I would have taken off of April of 2023 or April of 2022 when describing how our allies felt about us and being disappointed. And I don't know how much exactly this is going to change about this, because some people are characterizing it as a commitment to reach 1.76% of GDP, which I don't take it to be at all. I think it's an observation about how the arithmetic might work out if all the economic and fiscal spending projections hold, which is a whole bunch of contingent assumptions there, which historically have not borne out, which is very different than making a commitment to reach a certain threshold. But having put all that nuance in there, it's not actually the threshold that we committed to spend at, right? Like the last NATO summit, we committed to spend at least 2% of GDP. And we've just published a new plan after another almost year of deliberation after the Vilnius summit, and came forward with a plan that doesn't take us to the mark that we just committed to. Obviously we're having this conversation before the 2024 federal budget gets published. Maybe there's significant additional spending to come shortly. But I would surmise that if the government had a plan to get closer to 2%, they probably wouldn't have been shy about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, one of the key things that I took away from this, or noted from this DPU, was the fact that they want to overhaul, in essence, defense procurement. I kind of smirked at that when I read it, because, you know, I've been hearing that for 20 plus years and not one government has ever done it. And everyone recognizes that it's a problem. And so, Kristen, I would love to get your perspective on that. And I think, Alan, you'd probably be a good person to chime in as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do think within this document is, well, there is a commitment to procurement reform, whatever that is. We do know that there are initiatives underway, some that are longer term initiatives, some that are low hanging fruit. And there, you know, the department charged with doing that right now, or that is taking point on it, is PSBC. So we're aware that there are initiatives underway. There are a lot of things that were covered in the document that were not put under procurement reform, but require procurement reform in order to go forward. So, you know, for me, the start of a procurement reform looks something like continuous capability sustainment initiative, which you cannot do unless you are prepared to make some reforms in the procurement system. Everything from changing likely the way money works. So you'll have to have more mobility, if you want to call it that, you know, money that somehow slips between vote one and vote five. And I look at that, if you can get some of those things underway, then you start to be able to have conversations about some of the bigger ticket items. I'll address this right off the top, Alan. I don't agree with you about the single minister, especially not at this time. I think, in fact, at this time, it would be a disaster. I think a large machinery of government change. We've seen, you know, Shared Services Canada take 10 years to pop out the other side. I think it would be horrendous in a situation where we're hammering on them repeatedly for a sense of urgency and for releasing the things that they have already been working on for a couple of years. And I think, you know, it would just become a place where people who want to rag the puck will rag the puck. I mean, you know, industry, when we make reorganizations in companies, people rag the puck for months, hiding behind reorganizations in order to, you know, avoid making change. So, you know, I'm certainly against it at this time. And I've always felt like it's a seductive answer to a situation where, you know, has layers and layers and layers upon governance. And if in the last 2 years, no one has ever wanted to unpack the little bits that they hold on to, and everyone's more than willing to point their fingers at other places along the chain, it doesn't bode well for me just because you put somebody else in charge of it, right? If you don't want to do the hard business of rolling up your sleeves, it doesn't matter who's your boss. And it doesn't matter whether you have one of them or two of them. You're not going to do it if you don't want to do it. I think if we want to get some things in a reasonable amount of time, we need to stop talking and actually do the things that we have potentially within this as policy cover and a number of other initiatives that are low-hanging fruit and start and not be afraid of whether they're perfect or whether in some cases even they take a little bit of risk and they don't land the way they were supposed to. The outcome is slightly different, but perhaps a slightly better than what we're experiencing right now. Dave's got his hand up. I'm sure he has a lot to offer too.
I mean, fundamentally, Kristen's getting at the procurement aspect of implementation on this, which I think, I mean, that's fundamentally, I think most of our Canadian defense policies don't fall short because of the prose doesn't flow the right way. It succeeds or fails based on what actually gets done with it, how much of it gets implemented, how much money gets spent, how many troops get brought on, trained up to become operational capability. And I would point to one, I think one of the biggest weaknesses of the implementation plan, such it is that's laid out, is that the target to get back to even strength for the military's establishment is 8 years long. And if you go into accountability, as best I can tell, it's the military that's responsible for recruiting, that's responsible for training, that's responsible for retention. There's some other interconnected aspects of involvement with security screening and some other things. But fundamentally, that's on the military. And I think an awful lot of this is notional. If you can't get that recruit timeline to get up to get up back to even strength, essentially down under 8 years. Because if you don't have the people to operate all this equipment, there's not a whole heck of a lot of point in buying it.
Dave, I think many of the panelists today have alluded to this, but the biggest crisis facing the Canadian Armed Forces right now is the personnel crisis. And, you know, we buying kit, but not having the operators is something that we have to start anticipating now. And it's due to two reasons. One, there's a malaise right now in the Canadian Armed Forces caused, in my view, as the former Conservative leader, largely by poor leadership in terms of the government. And we had a chief of defense staff who, you know, without getting into that whole saga, was not the right person to take on the military sexual trauma issues. But we have to also, the second thing is, the Gen Z and millennial recruiting pool, all our allies are having the same problem. People are not joining institutions, let alone the most challenging institution to join, the military. And so I think we're going to have to launch a series of initiatives to solve this. Technology and use of AI, and I know the military is looking at many of these things, will maybe take the pressure off some roles, but not the hard and fast operators in the Army, Navy, and Air Force. So how do we address this? I think it has to be a combination of innovation and pay. I've long said that the unlimited liability that comes with serving in the Canadian Armed Forces should attract higher salaries than all other parts of the government writ large when you're willing to put it on the line for your country. So I think a combination of incentives, of programs, of working with new Canadians and diaspora communities, and then trying to work with allies on the wider issue of attracting Gen Zs. And part of that will be by restoring the pride and the professionalism of the forces, which has kind of wavered in recent years.
David, you mentioned something about permanent residence. I think that's key, important to note.
I mean, I think that Aaron's got a bit of a point with some of that, but I think getting those people actually into the forces in a timely manner, I think, is in a macro sense, a bigger part of the issue. They've had well over 10,000 permanent residents applied before it became evident that that was not a path to actually getting a job in any kind of reasonable time frame. And I think it was the stat that the Minister of Defense quoted that they'd had something like 16,000 applicants and got less than 100 actually into uniform. Hard to think that that didn't have some kind of spillover effect when people knew other people that applied and had an application not actually go anywhere and result in a paying job. I think there's a bunch of structural issues in that there's definitely a need to tap into wider communities. I think we've seen evidence that there's people in non-traditional communities that are absolutely interested. I don't think they're particularly interested in waiting around for over a year before they have the pleasure of actually starting to earn a paycheck, though. And if you can't crack that nut, you can make things as attractive as you want to any particular population set. But if you want good people that are eager for work, languishing for upwards of 12 months is not a good way to get them into uniform.
Completely agree. And the same goes for the people that are in uniform that are waiting to get into their actual trades. You know, I've seen people at bases that have been on the job training, OJT, for like 2+ years, you know, and I'm like, you guys are just kind of marking time, doing nothing. You know, yeah, they're earning a paycheck, but, you know, they're actually not getting to their vocation, you know, and it's sad. It's sad. So I'd like to ask the panel, do you think that this is a mature defense policy? Is it reflective of what's needed?
Well, no. I mean, in some respects, it's a defense policy that took a maturely long period of time to get out. But is it mature when you look at policies, perhaps of like our allies? I don't think so. I mean, Alan had a very good point in that it isn't correlated to foreign policy. Now, again, there's a nice nod to it actually being updated in conjunction with a national security policy, which is 10 years old. So I think a mature nation would understand that all of those things are correlated and would be keeping these type of documents evergreen, number one. And number two, I also agree that there would be a heck of a lot less that would be in exploration. We would have a much better view of, you know, for example, urgent operational items, certainly replacements for the CAF. You know, I asked myself what was going on the last year in selecting replacements for either Leopards or M777s, right? I mean, come on. The kit was gone 2 years ago in some cases, and we still need to explore what that replacement item will be. That doesn't suggest to me that we're a very mature nation in terms of this whole process around creation of a defense policy and what goes into it, not to mention how long it took to get out. So I'd say no. But again, I'm one of those people that believes if you don't start somewhere at risk of people, you know, tearing it all apart and, you know, essentially calling it a disaster, then no one will ever take the risk of putting something out there that can be critiqued. So it's better to put something out to be critiqued, whether it's, you know, junior or senior. And we've got the junior version of it, but at least we're moving as opposed to being inert.
Yeah, thanks, Christian. I appreciate that. Aaron, what are your thoughts?
I was very disappointed in terms of, is it a mature policy for Canada at this point in geopolitical history? No, it misses the mark. And I'll say why. We just celebrated the 75th anniversary of NATO last week. There's the potential for the next U.S. president to be elected. If it's Mr. Trump again, he has contemplated dissolving or pulling out of NATO. And one of the main reasons he uses is that there's free riders. There's people not paying their fair share. So this was an opportunity for us to express a strong commitment to the international rules-based order and the most important security alliance that has provided the blanket of security for Europe over the last 75 years. And why it's not mature is because we were one of the first four countries involved in the creation of NATO. There was 12 originally. We just expanded with two more members in the last year as a result of the war in Ukraine. But Louis Saint-Laurent, Lester Pearson were core to the creation. In fact, the early problems with the Security Council at the UN, Lester B. Pearson and other people were very critical of the inability for the UN to respond. And that was part of the reason NATO really was formed. So we had an opportunity to commit to a plan for 2%. My friends on the panel have talked about challenges procurement and a whole range of things. But if we committed to a 10-year plan to meet our 2% target and to take a lot of the exploring options off and say, we will do these things, that's what we should have done at this point, where we may regret in a few years if this the NATO alliance has difficulty not committing more responsibly when we had a window to do that. After all, and I said this in a speech at a 75th event in Toronto hosted by the NATO Association of Canada, Article 2 of NATO is known as the Canadian Article, which is we use this security and this alliance to then build trade and then build broader ties for global peace and security. We have a chance to really recommit to that. And I think by not doing it, sure, people will say it's just a number, it's just a target, but it's a way to show our belief in multilateralism. And I think that's why it wasn't the mature policy we could have had at this critical time in world history.
You know, we talk about 1.76. I mean, there's no assurity of a 1.76. The numbers just aren't there to substantiate any kind of real commitment. And that's what bothers me. We're talking about 1.76 like that's us, you know, that they've got a plan to get there. They don't have a plan to get there. And I won't believe they have a plan. And until I see rigorous costing to show me how they're getting to that number. And so, you know, I don't think this is not only mature, I don't even think it's junior. I mean, this is a kindergarten kind of document in terms of what the leaders of this country should be putting forward after waiting years and years and years. All we have is vague generalities. All we have is dozens of things that we're going to explore and study. There's nothing in it, frankly, to base and say, okay, I see your plan. I see your vision. I see where you're taking the Army, Navy, and Air Force. It's clear to me, and we can monitor you and hold you to account for the kinds of commitments they're making. There's just very general kind of stuff in there, and that's what I'm saying. The next government won't have to worry about living up to these commitments because there really isn't anything hard in there. Maybe I have different expectations, but when you have a prime minister and senior people elected to leave this country, I expect them to have substance behind their words. And these are just words that are meant just to sort of pacify people. You know, they delayed, delayed, and delayed. Now they're putting something out. So to me, we should be demanding a lot more from our leaders. We don't. And that's why they continue to get away with this stuff that really, really doesn't serve its citizens at all.
Fundamentally, I agree 100% with you, Alan. I think we need to ask more of all of our leaders, regardless of topic. David, I have to allow you a chance to share your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is that it's showing how out of line Canadian expectations are with the rest of the world. And I would say that because I think in a Canadian context, again, like I put this together as sort of the last part of the trilogy here on the government's, the Trudeau government's behalf, Strong Secure Engage, the NORAD modernization announcement, and then this one, like add it all together. It's like in the neighborhood of $250 billion is big money in a Canadian context. But given where we started from and given successive years of underinvestment, it still leaves us falling short of the NATO commitment. Even if we hit 1.76%, which also requires the GDP forecast that underpinned that to come in as delivered. And if you look historically, finance tends to give a little bit of a padding there when it, for all the kinds of good reasons. But that means that if you're working out a ratio as a share of your economy that's 5 years out, you're likely to under deliver on that, all things being equal, even if you hit the spending part of it. And we have all, all the list of things that are there only for exploration, which could have been a longer list, for sure. And some of the things that Kristen mentioned, I mean, we're in a dynamic right now with the largest land war and most significant land war in Europe in 80-ish years. And we don't have a plan to replace our tanks. So we don't have a plan to replace our light armored vehicles. We don't have a plan to replace our artillery. I'm not an army officer, but those things seem kind of germane in the current threat environment. Kind of an interesting question to me about what the future of the Canadian Army is a bit of a parenthesis of this document. Both the Navy and the Air Force, I think, pretty clear vision for how that fits into I was about to say Canada first, Aaron, and how to an Arctic first, North America second Arctic policy is framed. A little less clear about how the Canadian Army fits into that vision. But again, all to say, like at a time when allies are making huge commitments to both bolster and certainly replace parts of their army that have been donated to support Ukraine. Well, we're not making those kinds of commitments. I do think for all the good things you could say about this, and I would take Kristen's point about things that made it in here, I can now have forward progress on them, which would not have been the case in the absence of this document. But it's leaving us out of step with core allies in a number of different ways, not just financial, but in terms of some of the specifics too.
Thanks, David. And that is exactly what I was referencing when I was saying, is it a mature document? Because you pointed out some of the things that, should, in my opinion, be in there and should be set forth. But yeah, we're going to explore a lot of things, it seems like. So it's interesting. Even if the money is there, can it get spent? Because I think that's also been a problem, right? It's great to say, okay, you're getting more money up to 1.76% of GDP if we get there. Can the institution, can the Department of National Defense, all the other government organizations, can they spend the money? Because from what I've seen, they are challenged at doing that, whether it be from personnel or what have you, or just the bureaucracy. The system doesn't enable things to get out there fast. I'd love to hear all of your perspectives.
So my answer is, of course, if people want it to happen.
Right.
If there's political will to do this and you can align all the different bureaucratic instruments, of course, especially because, as has been already noted earlier, I think more so than Strong, Secure, Engaged, the spending was laid out in what I would call a pragmatic implementation plan. I think there was a recalibration after Strong, Secure, Engage, which even though it was back-end loaded, had more front-loaded than this document did. So I think there's been some recalibration of expectations about how quickly things could move. So particularly when you're talking about, as an example, there's a financial commitment to buy airborne early warning aircraft, basically at the end of the 20-year window, if you look at the profiling of the money. Surely from now, we can buy new airplanes 17 or 18 years from now, which is how I would interpret the profile of the money.
It's a long way out for sure. But yeah. Alan, can we spend the money?
Sure. We did. You said it yourself. There's a lot of bureaucracy. Remove half the bureaucracy by having one minister accountable. It's not all that complicated. It takes twice as long with two ministries. I know Kristen doesn't think it's right, but I would remind her that CADSE promoted this in December 2009. I don't know what's changed. I know the government in 2019, Trudeau government mandated asked its ministers to try to bring it together. I don't know why it hasn't been done. I've researched it. It could be done easily and effectively within a year if people wanted to do it. But Christine's right. Nobody wants to do it. They'd rather complain about the complexity and the bureaucracy and taking all the time than doing something that will make it faster with performance measures. Drucker once said that without performance measures, any organization descends into mediocrity. That's what it is. You have performance measures. You can have it only with one minister, monitor the whole system, and you'll get results quickly and effectively.
Aaron, you were in government. Maybe you have some insight that we don't.
Gosh, there isn't a day that it goes by that I didn't wish that I'd won the 21 election. We'd be actually delivering on some of these things, because I do think it can be done. It takes political will and it takes leadership. And, you know, even in recent memory, look at what the war in Afghanistan led to. It led to some very quick purchases. The C-17 is a great example. States are permitted to show domestic preference. You're also able to do sole source, depending on what you need. There's more flexibility in military purchases than any other part of the economy because of the nature of it. The trouble has been, and this is something I think both red and blue have had problems with, is we are known as a difficult place to do business, and we are uncertain. So that makes it hard for industry to make the investments they need to scale up to do some of these things. Look at the challenges we're having with the shipbuilding strategy and the ships. That's a core capacity, and I think it's good that Canada, and I was a big supporter of that program in the Harper government, but the uncertainty around defense procurement in Canada has caused difficulties and gaps that need to be addressed. So part of the miss with this document, by saying we're exploring a number of things and you know, not really articulating what we're going to do and on what time frame, even as David said, the AWACS reference, I think they've you know, put a few hundred million dollars sort of aside for a program like that when, you know, you're talking about billions for a program like that. So I think we need to give industry a runway to make the capital investments to be able to predict the flow. And in some cases, we need to do direct sole source purchasing. I think the Poseidon was a bit of an example of that. And I think that that's smart and strategic. We also need to look at some areas of outsourcing. We're going to be short personnel. We talked about waiting for training. You get a secondary use of veterans when you, some case, outsource some of these training and other services so that you can focus on core competency. So if there's political will, if there's leadership, I'll leave my colleagues to debate the single minister piece. There needs to be a demonstration of a plan and an ability to hold people account to deliver on it.
Yeah. And if I were to throw in my two cents, I've always been a proponent for a single minister. I think if you can point your finger at one person, as opposed to multiple people who can all pass the buck, I think my personal belief is that's a better approach. Kristen, all this money is coming towards industry. Ultimately, I think, you know, I'd love to get your perspective. What are your thoughts?
Well, depends. I mean, does it come towards Canadian industry or does it come towards foreign industry, right? That is the question. And to the point that we've just been talking about, can it be spent? Absolutely. Will it be spent building anything in this country for as a legacy? Time will tell. So I am a bit cautious around that, right? To Aaron's point, the signals and the noise are you know, we've got a lot of signal and noise at the same time. And I think we've come to a point in defense procurement where we need to become more strategic as a nation. We need to understand what capability we want in this country and what industrial base goes with it, and then preference it. And that's not also to say that you cannot do that in an expedient way, and also decide what you will source from a foreign capabilities wise and what you want transferred into this country from an operation and maintenance point of view. Those aren't hard conversations to have. They're about outcomes that you want to see and the nation that you want to build. And we can't no longer, I think, hand-wring for 10, 15 years while we suss out what our industrial base should look like and what choices we want to make. You know, we have to start making those choices, good or bad. So, you know, can money be spent? Yes. Could it be spent wisely if we wanted it to? But it will require hard choices to be made. And you know, I think even industry, to some extent, says, don't compete things if you have no intention of actually, you know, looking at what's coming out of that competition and acting upon it, right? If you've made the decision, make the damn decision and move forward. It serves none of us any good to be oscillating around for years at a time and having investment made either in the front end in bids and proposals in marketing dollars, and by nature, making the defense in Canada be a very uncertain market, even if it purports to have some level of certainty by running competitions.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And it's a great segue to ask about the four-year cycle of going back and looking at things. Is that realistic? Because it takes a long time. Well, I guess really it depends on how detailed you want to get, but it takes a long time to put something out. Is a four-year cycle a realistic goal, and will it be helpful?
With regard to this question, I think it's absolutely doable if you're committed to doing it. You could put out the kind of garbage we've seen today every couple of years. It's not going to take much effort. But if you really commit yourself to doing something the right way, you organize yourselves to do it. The other thing I just want to make, I want to go back to Christine's point, which I totally agree with. And we're one of the only country in the Western world that I'm aware of that does not have a 21st century defense industrial plan. We don't have one. The only thing we do in Canada is, in theory, buy ammunition and build ships. That's not a result of a clear policy thing, but just because of Treasury Board missions that have occurred. So we need to get to do that. And the other thing, too, in terms of getting the work done, you know, we're the only country in the world that has defense procurement as part of its legislative framework. And I think that's good, because I think, to Christine's point, it does allow us to use Canadian industry to advance, acquire these goods, if we use the Act smartly. It does, however, limit when we can and cannot sole source. And again, if you abide by the structure of the clauses in there and understand them, you really can use them to Canadian industry's advantage. And that's what we need to do. Just apply the rules smartly and effectively, and Canadian industry can be the great beneficiary.
David?
Doing those kinds of reviews in a four-year cycle is absolutely achievable. Most of our allies do it that often. You know, so in Canada, we do them basically when governments want them. I think all of us on the call could agree that a national security review less than once every 28 years, which if the commitment made in the policy released April 8th of 2024 bears out, except there wasn't actually a national security policy or strategy released, you would see the review in 2028. And the first and only one was done in 2004. I mean, that's just bonkers in a bunch of different ways. And I think the other thing I would say is that if you actually made it an institutional thing, you'd probably make it easier to keep doing it. I think one of the issues that we have right now, not that I don't think it by any means explains the whole two-year gestation period on this policy, but the fact that we don't do them on any kind of like cyclical planning basis means that everybody's kind of going to go back to a blank sheet of paper and come up with a methodology that's going to be used each time. Whereas if you look at other things that are routine parts of government, like the estimate cycle, the budget cycle, all those kinds of things, there's all mechanism, there's standard operating procedures. People kind of like have a template from which to work. If you were to make it a more regularized thing, I think it would make it easier to keep doing them. And I think it might also change some behavior on the part of the Department of Defense and the Armed Forces, incidentally, too, right? Like if you knew that you were going to have on a regular cadence an opportunity to review and revisit some decisions to make changes, there'd probably be a bit of a behavioral adaptation of not, you know, having your one kick at a can potentially for each government, which might lead to some interesting and potentially productive changes in terms of behavioral approach.
Aaron, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with my colleagues here that we can and should do this very regularly in terms of reviewing our national security policies, defense, foreign affairs. I think we could also make better use of parliamentary committees. You know, if you look at the U.S. approach, the ranking members, like they start to build up real capacity within their elected officials who understand national security, intelligence, defense far better than our parliament does. And in fact, rotating ministers of foreign affairs, rotating committee members, I think we need to professionalize that as well and not just rely on the civil service, which tries ably to do this, but with revolving deck chairs and so many MPs that don't have any personal experience or insights into these things. NCICOP, the Committee for Intelligence Oversight of Parliamentarians, it's too bad so much of what it does is secret. It is a professional committee of parliamentarians that built up real subject matter expertise. Perhaps we should mandate these reviews of our security policy, foreign policy within Parliament every 2 years and make sure that we're crafting policy. I think it would give more certainty to industry as well if we're able to clearly set plans and then measure them on the public record almost every other year. I think the state of the world right now, with 2 years of the war in Ukraine, tensions in many other parts of the world, I think we have to take this more seriously.
Kristen, what are your thoughts about this cycle?
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, every G7 nation practically does this, except for us. And they do it on a quite frequent cycle. If the Brits can do it, the Australians can do it, we're just not seized with it, right? And I mean, I agree with what everyone has said that, you need also the nation to be asking for it. You know, we need as a nation to be demanding our leaders. I think, Alan, you said something along those lines. We need to be demanding that our leadership actually has those conversations. We need to be demanding that, of our politicians and of leaders within the public service. But is it in the realm of the impossible? Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think we all agree that the more information that gets out there, the more feedback, the better. So we're out of time. I'm going to just say as a quick yay, nay perspective on this DPU. Alan?
It's a suboptimal document, to say the least. That something is better than nothing. I'm glad they finally did something. And I think, as Christine just said, and I've said, others have said, I think going forward, let's expect and demand more from our politicians. So when the next one does come out, it's a lot more rigorous and clear in terms of positioning Canada as part of the world.
David?
So like Alan, with all the preambulatory context I put out before, yay.
Aaron?
Proof's in the pudding. You know, right now it's just talk. They have to walk the walk. And that's what I'll be waiting to see.
And Kristen?
Well, I think I said it at the beginning, let not the perfect be the enemy of the, modest. So I'll still give it a yay. It had to come out.
Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody. Kristen Tianferani, Aaron O'Toole, David Perry, and Alan Williams, my guests for this episode. I hope everyone enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you'll join in for another episode of CDR Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening in, and hope you have a wonderful day.
Tune in next time for another Canadian Defense Focus podcast from CDR Radio.
This episode is sponsored by ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems Canada, TKMSC for short. TKMSC offers Canada a broad product portfolio, world-leading non-nuclear submarines, high-end naval surface vessels, and outstanding naval electronic systems. Along with the recent contract award for remote mine hunting and disposal, TKMSC contributes to the national shipbuilding strategy through work on the JSS, AOPS, and CSC. The company, via full corporate support, intends to compete for the upcoming Canadian Patrol Submarine Project with the CD-212 family of submarines. With TKMSC's Canadian base of operations and its long-standing relationship with the RCN, plus its parent company's significant modern manufacturing facilities in Kiel, Germany, TKMSC has a commitment, capability, and capacity to ensure the success of Canada's upcoming submarine project. Visit the ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems website for more information and visit their booth at CANSEC to find out why 70% of NATO navies trust TKMS conventional submarine solutions.